matching overview solution for fastball locations in two straight counts, which is definitely a mouthful. And if you don't quite know what matching overview is, I'll hopefully explain that to you a little bit more and show you some cool stuff with it. But before I start, I want to paint a picture of what this type of event would look like. So imagine your favorite pitcher's on the mound. You're in the bottom of the ninth inning in a tie game, and you have two strikes on a hitter. And you already decided you're going to throw a fastball in situation. Your catcher's calling for that. The question now is, where do you want to put that pitch? Are you going to throw it high and outside, low and in? Are you going to go up and try and climb the ladder and make him chase? And that's a question that we really try and answer with our research. And it's really just starting a framework and hoping that this process can be applied in other areas and really advance game theory in the game of baseball. So just a little bit of history about what work's been done with game theory previously. This is not an exhaustive list, so if I left anything out major, please let me know. I'd love to read it. But so it really started with the book, and Mitchell Lichtman wrote a great chapter at the end of the book, which if you haven't read the book, I also recommend that. And he really was a qualitative explanation of how game theory applied to baseball, and he talks a little bit about pitch sequencing and pitch selection, whether to throw a strike or not. But he never gets into the calculations and really calculates for the Nash equilibrium or the optimal probability for which you should throw a strike or throw a different pitch. And then further, David Gaskill in 2010 at the Hardball Times wrote an article titled "When a Pitcher Meets a Hitter." And this was really the first article that I had seen where someone showed you the process that you would go through to figure out with what probability, optimally, a pitcher should throw a strike and a hitter should swing a pitch in that probability. However, he doesn't use real data. So it's all very crude, but the process is set. And it's something that you learn in a lot of your microeconomic classes in college. And it's something that's very straightforward and simple and it's never really been applied too much. And then Matt Schwartz, who's actually here today, can hopefully give an exciting presentation tomorrow on game theory stuff and some pitch sequencing, did his five-part series in the Hardball Times this December, which is a must-read for anyone who really is into game theory at all or baseball analytics in general. But so what we do is we take all of these approaches and kind of go one step further by applying pitch FX data to calculate the run value of each pitch. And we're only looking at fastballs, which we'll get to what data we use in a little bit. But using those run values, we're able to determine how valuable pitches are to these pitchers and how valuable those pitches are when a hitter swings or not. And then hopefully determine what we think is the optimal strategy. So our two questions are, first, where should pitchers locate fastballs in two strike counts? Very straightforward, simple question. The answer is not quite as straightforward. And then also, at the same time, when should hitters swing at these fastballs that pitchers throw? And those are the two things that we're trying to really get at. It's a dynamic system where they work together. So we do that in a couple of different ways. First of all, we take the discrete case, which you may be familiar with if you've looked at what Matt's done or what David Gaskill did at Hardball Times. And we do that for just in the strike zone, out of the strike zone for these fastballs and whether the hitter should swing or not. And then we get into the continuous case, for which we expand the strategy set for the pitcher, or in other words, instead of allowing the pitcher to only throw in the strike zone or out of the strike zone, he can throw to any single point in or out of the strike zone. And each of those points is classified differently and has a different run value associated with it. So that's where it gets really cool. And we go about solving that problem actually two different ways. One is through a simulation using a genetic algorithm, and if you don't know what that is, don't worry. I didn't until a few weeks ago, actually. And then also we do it with a numerical solution, using fitting a few functions and messing around with those and coming up with a good solution in our minds. And then we'll talk a little bit about what these results mean and how they can really help the sabermetric movement in baseball analytics in the future. So for the discrete case, our data set consists of all four-seam fastballs in 0-2, 1-2, and 2-2 counts. And please note, we do not account for handedness, so we take all righties, lefties in each case for the discrete case. And we do that because we don't think the handedness and the platoon split is as important with the discrete, because we aren't bucketing pitches by inside, outside, high, low, or movement. It's really just whether it's in the strike zone, a very binary system. So going on to the discrete case, one thing I wanted to find before I really get into this is the concept of the extended zone. We all know that pitchers, being a pitcher, I know this, pitchers are not pinpoint accurate when they're throwing. So if they're trying to throw a pitch in the strike zone, sometimes they may miss. And we try to incorporate some of that by using this extended zone concept. So when I talk about pitches in the strike zone for this in the discrete argument, I'm actually going to be referring to this extended zone. And as you can see here, the strike zone is this little bit, the inner square, defined by the rule book. And then this outer portion, the outer rectangular square here, is actually 10% added on each side. And that's what I'm going to be talking about with whether the pitcher can throw into that or not. And hopefully we think that it may incorporate some of that error and allow us to get a better measurement of what the pitcher's trying to do, which is what you want to instruct him and hope that he does, because you can't actually instruct a pitcher on where to locate it, but only where his goals to locate it are. And also, there's a little bit of a pitch recognition uncertainty. As you can see, this hitter is struggling mightily with understanding where that pitch is. He looks a lot like I did in high school. I was a terrible hitter, I could throw, and that's about it. But we all know that hitters don't necessarily recognize where pitches are going to end up perfectly. So we try and solve that problem and incorporate it into the discrete model as well. And we do that by calculating the probability that a pitch that's outside of the extended zone is recognized accurately and taken, and also the same probability for a pitch inside the zone that is swung at. And we will call those rec B for the ball recognition probability and rec S for the strike recognition probability. And we don't actually break this up by count, because when we did that, it added a layer of complexity, first of all, and we found that the numbers were fairly similar within about 10% of each other, and we don't think it would have made drastic differences in the process. If you were to do this yourself, you're more than welcome to do that, but I think you're chasing a margin there. So the way that we approach this and actually incorporate that into our data is what you're looking at right here is the hitter's swing matrix, actually, or his payoff matrix. And each cell there is the run value for the event that's described. So in the upper left corner, you have swing strike. So that's a run value to the hitter, or the payoff to the hitter and his utility, of when he swings at a strike. And as you can see, the same thing for swing ball, take strike, take ball. And that's fairly self-explanatory, I think. And the way that we incorporate the probabilities of the recognition probabilities is that we multiply the probability that he swings at a strike times the probability that he accurately recognizes that strike. And then similarly, for swinging at a ball, the probability that he inaccurately recognizes that ball, or he's wrong about that, and so on. So this actually changes the hitter's payoff matrix corresponding to how he recognizes these pitches. And now, so we have two payoff matrices, one for the pitcher and one for the hitter, and because of the corrections we apply to the hitter, they are slightly different. And the hitter has been changed while the pitcher one has not. And if you don't know any game theory, the way that you find match equilibrium in the discrete case is to find the point where the pitcher's strategy of whether to throw a strike or not makes the hitter indifferent on whether to swing. So what we do is we find the payoff or the utility for the hitter on a swing, which we find by taking the probability it's in the strike zone times the run value of swinging at a pitch in the strike zone. And that actually comes up with the run value based on the pitcher's strategy. And then we add to that the probability that the pitcher does not throw a pitch in the strike zone, and multiply it by the run value of swinging at a ball, and that gives us a total utility of swing. And we do the same thing for the utility of the take with the probabilities. And we set them equal and actually solve for that P zone variable. And what that does is gives us the optimal Nash equilibrium probability, given everyone's behaving rationally, which is definitely not always true, of how often a pitcher should throw in the extended zone. And to find the hitter's optimal strategy, we do the same thing below, where we set the utility of a pitcher of throwing in the zone or equal to the utility of the pitcher of throwing out of the zone, and solve for the probability of the hitter to swing. So we actually went and calculated this in first and 0-2 counts, and we also did 1-2 and 2-2, which I'll show you in a second. So we found that pitchers were not throwing strikes or into the extended zone nearly enough in Major League Baseball, at least in 2009 through 2011, and I would assume that it would hold as time went on into 2012. About 32% observed zone probability, while the optimal would be at 61%. And so that actually helps explain why the hitters are a little low, because as long as pitchers are throwing about half the strikes that they should be, hitters should not be swinging at the match equilibrium percentage. So as you can see, this actually carries over into 1-2 counts, where you have about a 40% observed zone probability and a 73% optimal. And then in 2-2 counts, a 48% observed zone and a 96.4% optimal. And as you can tell, the optimal actually of zone probability increases as you add more balls, because at that point the cost of a ball is much higher as you get closer to the event of a walk. So the discrete case is great. It really is a very crude estimate that is a great indicator of whether or not a pitcher is behaving optimally. However, there are some shortcomings, and most notably of those shortcomings is that all five of these pitches are exactly the same in the eyes of the discrete case. Despite the fact that this pitch in the low outside corner has a much lower run value associated with it on average than the pitch that's right down the middle of the plate, the model actually doesn't distinguish between them. So that's why we actually end up going to the continuous case. And in the continuous case, every single one of these pitches is classified differently. It has its own run value, and that allows for much more accurate estimate and a more accurate model of what's going on. So to make the continuous case from the discrete case, there's a few assumptions you have to make. And one of them we make for our simulation is that the discrete can be made pseudo-continuous. And so you can see here we divided up the zone, which was one bucket, into a 2x2 array. And that's what it looks like. If you make that 5x5, it looks like that. If you make n, or the number of buckets on each side, equal to 12, it looks like that. And if you keep making n higher, you actually get, as the limit of n approaches infinity, for any math people out there, you actually get what is continuous, and it looks like this. And that's a very large n on the computer screen, actually. It is pixelated, it's not continuous, but you would never know the difference. So we do make that assumption, and that's one way that we approximate the continuous case using discrete game theory. So another thing is, hitters don't make decisions when the pitch is at the plate. It would be very easy to hit if you could decide whether or not you're going to swing when the pitch was right here. That's just not true. And Dave Baldwin, a baseball analyst a couple years ago, actually wrote an article in which he hypothesized and suggested that hitters must make a decision about 270 milliseconds after release on average for 90 mile an hour fastballs. So we take this assumption and incorporate that into our model. And this is about where that would be on average. And that does vary for every pitch based on velocity. So what we do is we take the location after 270 milliseconds from release using pitch FX data, and we project it onto this plane D. So it's one vertical plane, and each pitch gets a location DX and DZ on that plane, and based on those values in that location, hitters must decide whether or not they should swing through a binary variable. And as I talk more, every time I discuss the hitter's decision-making process, it's all based on this D plane, and I'll make sure to try and use DX and DZ, however I may slip up once or twice. I apologize for that. So for the continuous case, we change our data set. We still use 2009 through 2011. However, we control for handedness, because now inside-outside matters, as well as in the direction the pitch moves in. Everything like that is much more important when you're talking about the difference of a couple of inches within the zone rather than a very discrete binary case. And the first way we approach the continuous case is through a simulation. And the question may be, why would we simulate? It's not always the best way to do things. It's definitely an approximation and usually the second best way. But this is a very difficult math problem that we put ourselves in. We thought this was a very good way to approximate that and come up with one solution for it. So it's very complicated because the pitcher's choice is not discrete. It's very continuous strategy set that he has to choose from. But at the same time, the hitter has a binary choice. It's swing or not. And that causes this to have a little bit of difficulty in the modeling case with that. So we decided that we should do a simulation. And we make a few assumptions. First of all, as I said, that hitters swing at about 270 milliseconds after release. And that, as I said before, a finitely discrete case is continuous. In our case, for the sake of computation, we divided the throw zone from -2 to 2 in the x direction and from 0.5 to 4.5 in the z direction into an 8x8 array. And that could definitely be made finer, but for the sake of what our computers that are not that advanced can handle overnight, we made it an 8x8. And then we also assumed that run values are fit from data and that they're location account specific, but they don't change with pitcher or hitter strategy. And because of that, it's very hard. Each pitch is considered independent of other pitches. So the pitch sequencing aspect is not included in this model, and it's something that we hope can continue in the future as this is developed more. So there are pitcher and batter strategies where the pitcher chooses his location, PX, PZ, which is in the P plane, which is at the plate, and he tries to throw there, while the hitter, based on his DX and DZ, there's a probability associated with throwing to that spot. And the pitcher actually gets a matrix of probabilities for each bucket in our array. So the question then is, based on where the pitcher tries to throw it, where does it actually end up? Those aren't necessarily always the same. And in our case, with our model, we incorporate that. And this is a scatter plot of Mariano Rivera's fastballs, actually. And as you can see, there are two distinct clusters, one on the inside part of the plate and one on the outside part of the plate. What we do is we take those clusters and we assume, which is a very crude assumption and definitely not correct and it has to be improved, that he's trying to throw, every time he throws into one of those clusters, his intended location is right in the center. And we fit those pitches and then to a bivariate normal distribution, from each location, we say we can keep the standard deviation of the X and Z direction in the row, which controls the skew of that distribution. But we take the intended location as the new mean and draw the outcome from that bivariate normal distribution. So then the hitter, actually, we use the bivariate normal distribution again. So he gets information, incomplete information from the with DX and DZ values. And he ends up having to figure out where that pitch will end up on the PX and PZ plane. And we actually draw that value in the bivariate normal distribution based on the average of where it would end up from where it starts in the D plane onto the P plane. And the standard deviation around that is just distribution. So where it ends up based on the hitter's judgment is not an exact science as well. So each pitch has a run value associated with it, and we set that run value equal to a similar equation to I showed you in the discrete case, where the run value is equal to the probability he swings, which is SW of DX DZ, and then multiply that by the run value of a swing at the plate, and then also then add that to the multiplication of the probability of the take times the run value of the take. And we set that equal, and that's how we determine our run values for each pitch. And the way that we then approach this model and actually solve for the equilibrium solution or the optimal solution is to use a genetic algorithm. So for those of you who don't know what that is we input a seed population of 10 strategies for the hitter and 10 strategies for the pitcher in a matrix form, and they randomly mate and mutate with each other to create 100 strategies. And then every combination of those strategies plays against each other in a simulation. And the 10 strategies that, on average, maximize run value for the hitter, move on to the next round, and minimize run value for the pitcher on average, move on to the next round. And once again, they randomly mate and mutate. And that same process repeats itself 500 times. And we find that about after 500 times, we get a very stable outcome, and we're not going to get any more information by simulating it more. And that process actually takes all night to run on our computers, which don't have much computing power. But that's how we do it. And we actually have results here for 0-2, 1-2, and 2-2 counts. So this gray outline here on the outside is the hitter strategy set using contours. If you can't see it, the inner contour is 90% swings. And then it goes to, I believe, 60 and 30. And the red strategy set is a pitcher, and we find that he actually should intend to throw to one point location in each of these cases, where this is the point here, here, and here, is that red dot, where any rings around it represent the bivariate normal distribution that the pitches actually end up. So a couple important things to notice is, first of all, the outside part of the plate is favored, as you can notice actually from the catcher's perspective, if we're looking at pitch FX data. And as you get more balls, we see that intended location move farther towards the center of the plate. And the reason for that is, as I said earlier, the cost of a ball is much higher in counts when there are more balls and as you approach a walk. So that definitely explains that. And as you can see, because of that intended location in the center, we see pitches that are very distributed evenly vertically throughout the zone. And I think that's a result of the large standard deviation that we use in this model. So we actually did the same thing using a smaller standard deviation. This one's based on the Mariano-Rivera fastballs on the left, and this one is an extreme command pitcher, which would normally be Mariano-Rivera, with a .25 standard deviation, which is or a quarter of a foot, or 3 inches in each direction. And as you can see, it's actually much closer to the edge of the strike zone and also lower. So the low and outside pitches are favored slightly more. So that's the how we did the simulation. And now we're going to talk a little bit how we approach the numerical solution to this problem. And we made a few different assumptions. First of all, that hitters should swing at all pitches that are strikes and two strike counts, and they should take all pitches that are balls. And that's definitely a simplifying assumption. However, we do believe that it is correct. As you can see with the hitter's strategy set, it very closely mirrors what looks like the strike zone at that 90% and drops drastically very quickly after that. So it's definitely a simplifying assumption, but we think it does model reality quite well. So, and then we also assume that the strike zone is called as the rule book defines it for this model, and we hope that in the future we can change that, because we all know that's not the case whatsoever. But for our model, because of the difficult, we decided to focus more on how the difficult math problem and finding a process to solve it, and this can be incorporated later. And then also remember that the hitter strategy is fixed, as they should swing at all pitches that are strikes and take all pitches that are balls. So when should hitters swing based on those assumptions? We did similar to as in the simulation. We took a bivariate normal distribution, which looks like this, scramble of Greek letters, and we fit all of our data to that as whether or not there's going to be a strike based on its dx and dz locations. And these are the parameters that we came up with for mean in the x direction, mean in the z direction, and standard deviation in both directions, and then rho, which once again is the skew of the distribution, or how it's kind of rotated on its axis. So this is what we came up with, and the locations of this mean absolutely nothing because they are on that ambiguous D plane that I talked about. But as you can see, it's your textbook bivariate normal in both directions with a little bit of skew on it. And each point on this plane here, this D plane, above it is a probability of the hitter should swing associated with it. Then the next question was to make run value functions. For those of you that are more math heavy and have taken some linear algebra, I'm not going to go over the details. However, there's a little information on the slide. If you want to know more, please come up to me after. I'll talk to you about how we did this. We actually projected the data onto the column space of a matrix that and fit it to a fourth degree bivariate polynomial. That's all I'll say about the math. I think it's fun. But and we end up with a fourth degree bivariate polynomial based on dx, dz data. And what that tells us is the run value at each spot. And we did this for pitches that the hitter swung at and pitches that they took. And these are what we found. As you can see, these make a lot of sense as the run value of swing peaks in the middle of the strike, the middle of where pitches would end up in the strike zone, and diminishes as it goes away from that. And for a take, it's almost binary. In the center, it's very low, as those are strikes if you take it. And on the outside, it's very high, as they are balls. So then the question became, how do we combine this information to get the total payoff function for a pitcher? And as you may be able to guess, if you've been following closely, it's that same formula that we used in all of these. So here it is. The probability of a strike, or the probability of a swing times the run value of swing, plus the probability of take, which is 1 minus the probability of swing, times the run value of take. And P there is the swing probability, if you didn't pick up on that. And this is a function we get on the D plane, please note, so the locations are very ambiguous and have no meaning. But this is exactly what we'd expect it to look like, as there's a slight donut here, and these are pitches that are going to be on the outside of the zone, so they're pitches that are swung at and taken as strikes, but when they are hit, there's not a lot of contact. And then in the middle of that donut are pitches that are swung at often because they're down the middle of the plate, but they're right in people's power zones. So the run value of a swing is actually much higher there. And as you get away from the middle of the strike zone, it increases to pitches that are balls every time, as no one would take them. Or everyone would take them. So then the question became, how do we transform this ambiguous function on the D point to what it actually looks like when a pitcher is trying to figure out what they're doing at the plate? Because that's what we're interested in. We only care about, in this situation, what the pitcher's trying to do. Where is he trying to look at the pitch? And we did that through a linear regression. To no surprise to us, dx locations are very strongly linearly correlated with px positions. And dz and pz are as well. So a simple linear regression, and we were able to change and shift the function over and by inputting the variables with the linear regression. And this is what we got. So then the idea is the pitcher's main goal here is to minimize his run value, right? Each point on this figure represents the run value of a pitch given what the hitter is going to do optimally. So now he just wants to figure out where he has to put it to minimize his function. And if you actually do minimize it, you find that there is one point that's lowest. However, there is error in each of the approximations and the projections and the MLE that we do. So we actually set a barrier and say everything under this is approximately the same run value. And this is what it looks like when we do that. All of the green are about the same run values or the lowest. And we suggest that pitchers randomize their selection of fastballs over these locations. And we found that actually the high fastballs that on the high part of the zone were what popped up first as we lowered the threshold. So they actually might have a slightly lower run value or more favorable to the pitcher. But this is what we found for the numerical result. And you may be wondering why it's slightly different than the simulation. And the main, as you can see, this chose one point, which is about here. And if you chose one point, this one is about there. So it's very similar. But what this model, the numerical model, does not incorporate that the simulation does is the bivariate normal distribution centered around the pitchers not being able to accurately locate their pitches. This model assumes that pitchers are perfect and can throw wherever they would want to. And it's something, that's another something that we hope that can be incorporated to the model at some point. But that's why, and it's because of that standard deviation that's incorporated into the simulation but not the numerical solution. So the results actually do coincide fairly well because this ends up throwing pitches that are high end, or this simulation model ends up instructing the pitcher to throw pitches that are high and low, while this one does the same. So a few applications of this. How can this help MLB teams? Why is it interesting other than the cool math behind it? So it helps catchers with the pitch calling, and I know we talked a lot about yesterday and today about how hard it is to approach catchers, and that's definitely a less pertinent application of this, but if at some point there are certain catchers, Jason Baratek was mentioned yesterday, that would benefit and really are having more analytical lens through pitch calling, it's something that you could show them. But the more important aspect is in the front office. I think it could be a way to value players and figure out if you have a player who has dominant stuff, very plus fastball, and this can also be done with curveballs and other pitches. So he has plus pitches, but he's not having success, and you can't really figure out why that is. Maybe he's not locating optimal. And this is a tool that can help you figure that out by overlaying where he is distributing his pitches and where the model recommends. So, and the same thing for catcher's pitch calling. There's a lot being done with pitch framing right now, but what's the value of how catchers call pitches and how they interact with their catchers, or with their pitchers? That's been hard to quantify. So, also, it may be valuable to compare to this model, instead of using the optimal swing probability for hitters, using what they do now, because that's much more applicable to what pitchers need to do. So some further work, improve the strike zone definition, find hitters' optimal strategy without defining it as a probability of a strike, which is definitely a simplifying assumption. It was very hard to do in some nasty partial differential equations if we wanted to do that, that were unsolvable, really difficult to approximate. And then to look at other pitch types and incorporate the repeated game aspect and with maybe a Bayesian updating system. So I'd like to thank Middlebury. They gave me some funding to come out here, as well as Sport Vision and Sabre for allowing me to speak. It's been an honor. As well as MLB Advanced Media for some of the data in Sport Vision as well. Brandon Henry helped with data visualization on one of our figures, so thank you to him. And please feel free to send me or Dave an email if you have any question. Actually, my card is also on that table back there if anyone wants it and has an abstract on the back. But at this time, I'll take any questions. I don't know how much time we have, but... How much time do we have, by any chance?
2 minutes.
2 minutes?
15.
15, perfect. Awesome. Yeah.
Thanks, that was a very nice talk. I didn't quite get. projecting from the D plane to home plate, what assumptions do you make?
So
I saw you did a regression, but
yes.
Does it take into account the direction that the ball is heading at the D plane?
No, it does not. So what we do is it's actually a very strong, the R squared is about 0.9 when we did it. So we figured that was a very predictive, where it is on the D plane is very predictive of where it is on the P plane.
So you just actually took data.
This is very data.
The 9 parameter fit to the data. Looked at where it was on the D plane,
and then
plotted where it was on the PXP home plane, and then did a regression.
Very simple linear regression. And I was actually surprised at how good the results are. I was just messing around and figuring out how we were trying to do it, and I ended up doing a scatter plot just to see what it looked like, and it was a straight line. I very, very, very rarely do you see things that are that correlated. So, yeah.
First off, thank you for bringing up genetic algorithms. I haven't seen those since grad school. So I never imagined I would see those at a baseball time. So what I took from your probability of throwing in the zone is that pitchers worry way too much about what the batter might do with a good pitch. I mean, it almost seems like, I mean, you look at like Curt Schilling. I mean, he was pounding the zone constantly. And so you see, like, I think Lopez or somebody may have said something about nibbling last night. And it just seems like these guys really should be pounding the zone at every single opportunity.
That is definitely supported by what we find. I know pitching to contact is it's kind of taboo for this audience. And I think the Twins actually do a good job. They recently have changed their methodology from pitching to contact to attacking the zone. I think that could be a valuable thing based on what we found doing this. The strike zone is your friend if you can locate within it. And definitely attacking that more would be beneficial.
So the other question I had is, I assume things would be, so on a 2-0 count, the batter has to look at the entire zone and the pitcher has a small area which expands. On a 2-strike count. On a 3-ball count, I assume that would be inverted, which would actually be a case where the pitcher would be much more likely to be throwing forcing fastballs.
Yeah, we actually did not include the 3-2 count, I meant to say this, because of the likelihood of the ball. It changes the game completely in the sense that the cost of throwing outside the strike zone for the pitcher is enormous as compared to when you have 0-2, 1-2, or 2-2.
I'd be very curious to see what the batter's probabilities look like.
Yeah.
When on a 3-0 count.
It's actually, if David Gaskins, when a pitcher meets a hitter, that's what he looks at. He looks at the 3-2 count. And
actually, 3-0.
Oh, 3-0. I'm sorry.
What should a batter be doing on a 3-0 count? Would it seem to me to be a interesting.
That'd be very interesting. We didn't look at that, but it'd be cool to see if you take every pitch, and a lot of people do that, and there are certain people that stand by that every time. But, yeah,
First of all, great presentation, Kevin. I really enjoyed it. I think you did great stuff with the game theory. I had a couple of questions. The first question, I really thought the result was fascinating, that when the pitcher has error in terms of how accurately he can throw it, he should basically be aiming at one specific spot. And yet when he knows exactly, he needs to be randomizing.
Yes, so to answer that, actually there is one specific spot on here, but we actually take the next step and use a little bit of inference. It's not definitely not statistical and mathematically sound to do this, but it's a little bit of inference and artistic license that we take to say, obviously in real life, they can't throw to one spot every time because the hitter will pick up on that, and our model doesn't deal with it. However, we assume that pitchers should be throwing to these similar spots and mixing up where they do it. And the best way is to randomize. I can't, because we didn't do a very technical analysis, I can't say whether that was uniform or what type of distribution that would follow. However, I think some sort of random process over there, I would guess uniform.
So you would think the probability is that the optimal solution is actually randomizing.
Yes, and that's something that game theory, you don't want to fall apart. I was talking to someone last night, I don't remember who it was, and it was about how it would be cool pitchers could wear wristwatches that actually just have a random number generator in them, and you choose a pitch based on that.
Interesting. And then the other thing, I really, for my presentation, I've been struggling with this concept that really kind of think about is, did you factor in hitter differences at all?
No.
And do you have any sense of how you might do that?
Yes, so we actually didn't get around to doing any case studies or applications looking at individual hitters, but it's something we thought about a lot. And the way that you for individual hitters, the way that you would do that is taking their swing function. So you have this bivariate normal swing probability function here. And instead of finding the optimal based on whether it's going to be a strike or not, you take what they're doing. And, so are you looking for what a pitcher should do against those hitters?
Yeah, how do you change the... I mean, how do both of them change their strategy? But I was thinking about the pitchers in terms of the hitter's ability to discern whether the ball is a strike and the hitter's ability to hit a charge.
So, I mean, you definitely fit this function differently. You fit this function based on what the hitter actually does in that case. And then that changes everything else. So these functions would say, you could also fit these functions in individual hitters if you would like. I don't think they would change drastically. I haven't played around, they may. But you could fit everything with the hitter's data rather than MLB as a whole, which is what we did for sake of sample size. Why not? But then if this is the function, you plug everything in that's fit to the hitter and the pitcher that you choose. And that's where we expect actually the cool applications of this come. I mean, this isn't groundbreaking. You throw in the strike zone, you nibble on the corners, you don't throw down the middle. That's not the most groundbreaking thing I've been told that my whole life is pitching. But where this could be groundbreaking is when you apply it in individuals. And I think that's when it gets really cool, because then this pattern might change completely. You may see, is an individual actually optimizing? Because then you don't have anything to change. Or are they not? And is that something you can change as a team? And you can actually pick up on that and then try and work with them on moving toward and converging towards the optimal. And that, and individual in scouting reports, it could change as well. It's interesting in finding undervalued assets is the best application I think of for it. But, makes sense. Yeah.
No, Kevin, my compliments as well. This creates just a whole lot of fun, for one thing, and probably application. Is this a square area of the strike zone?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So this entire square here is the throw zone. I don't know if it goes from -2 to 2 in the X direction.
Extended. And I was wondering if you're taking the corners out at the bottom.
What do you mean?
At the edges.
Oh, so these corners?
Yeah.
I wonder why. It really, the horizontal location isn't. And this gray box is a strike, so I'm sorry. I don't know. Can you see that?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Okay. Is there, And also, I wonder if you wanted to... play a game where you try to do the reflective reasoning, that I know where to throw, but the hitter knows where I know to throw.
That's the classic game theory. Very complicated. Very
wonderful, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you could model that. I mean, there's some machine learning stuff that could probably do that. There's a really cool presentation at Sloan. I was watching the video of it the other day. I don't know if it was this year or last year, of using machine learning to actually predict what pitch would be thrown. Not optimal, but I could imagine a similar concept being applied to figure out what the optimal pitch to throw is, using inputting information about what would be optimal using this information. I don't know enough computer science to do that, but if someone does, yeah.
Up to your other point, I think the Twins are just learning how to throw strikes.
You're a Twins fan, I take it.
In terms of genetic algorithms, I don't know what this data set, if it was an issue, but you mentioned that you just you pitted the two against each other. Did you have to? Oftentimes, when you do that without introducing like random variance, you get like local optimizations without getting either global. I don't know if it would affect this data set as much, just because it is so. It seems like there's like a couple optimals. But did you run into that issue at all?
I'm not sure. That's a question. Email Dave, or you can talk to me after. Dave was very important with the genetic algorithm. That was really him. He drove that. I've had no experience until a couple weeks ago with it, so I'm not really sure about how that works. If you talk to me after and send me an email, I'll definitely like it.
I'm thinking here of Galileo's comment once, where he said, "Sweet analytics, thou hast devoured me," and I'm wondering. Out of necessity, you had to make a number of simplifying assumptions that allowed you to actually attack the problem, and you're probably more aware of the consequences of those simplifying assumptions. It looks like this is, do you feel that this is at the point of people ought to start doing this, or do you feel that this is just a glimpse in the door, and if more research is done, say, perhaps before it's ready for prime time as to where teams and players would actually start applying this.
Did you guys hear that back there, by chance? Yes, okay. I definitely think there's more work to be done. I mean, we don't quantify any error on our estimates. That's something that's huge. We don't. This could be drastic. I mean, this fits what we'd expect, so it makes me think we did something right. But we haven't gone through and quantified the error in every step, and that's something that often we would have done by now. So it's I would not bring this out and show it to a pitcher today on the mound and say, this is what you need to be doing. I don't feel comfortable enough with that, but I think this is a start. I really want to see more game theoretic work applied, and Dave and I were hoping this could be something that would spark that in other people, and I was really excited to see what Matt's doing tomorrow. I can't wait for his presentation. Today, right. God, I can't keep track.
We hope you can refine this. Do you have any intent to go further with this, or the opportunity?
The opportunity's there. I don't know whether we're going to do that. We may move on to something else, revisit it later. We have a couple different ideas about what we want to do. This is definitely something we're considering doing more with. It's a really cool concept. I've enjoyed doing it, but we're not really sure. We have to talk about that when I get back to Vermont on Sunday. So, yeah, Dave.
When you use the non-speech, use the tangent as a variable, but use the Gregson definition for books, I was able to
look at the numeric. Was this a simulation or the numeric?
In the simulation.
So simulation, we actually don't assume the strike zone. It's not as important because we can fit run values. So the hitter strategy is actually solved for it through the simulation. It's not assumed.
So the discrete used the movable strike zone simulation.
The discrete did and the numerical, but the simulation did not. Yeah.
Okay. So did you see any differences in the data for right-handers versus left-handers in terms of the run value swing? Because the closer it skews to the outside of the strike zone.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons we did righties instead of lefties. We did not look at lefties. We took the data very early on, the data set of all righties, and just used that completely.
So it's all right-handed batters?
This is all right-handed pitchers, right-handed batters, for the continuous. The discrete, not we used both. But we didn't distinguish. Any questions? Yeah, Josh.
Can you talk a little bit about the input, the genetic algorithm that
you use? Yeah, so it's in matrix form. So we input initially 10 seed strategies that are essentially chosen as what around in the strike zone. And they randomly initially make 100. And the same thing for the hitter. So the pitcher strategy looks like each bucket in the array gets a probability associated with it. And they're all obviously non-negative, they're greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero, and they sum to one because it's a probability distribution. Those are the constraints on that. And then for the hitter, those same rules don't apply. It's given just whether they would swing or not, what the probability of swing based on that location, but it's actually on the D point, and then it's converted. So that's really, those are the two input strategies. Does that help at all? Anyone else? Thank you. This is my first one really entering the world with this. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
You know, I think so, you know, that's...